Welcome to Innovation Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have Russell Curran. Russell, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Excited to be here.
Well, I'm glad. People who listen to the show know that I got my first sales job, like, I'm trying to do the math here, 28 years ago. And I feel like I've been a sales guy the whole time since, even CEO of my own investment funds. I'm just top sales guy. And about, 13 years ago, I thought, like, man, if I learned marketing, I wouldn't have to do so much selling. So I'm like a closet, like obsessive, like marketing book reader. And I think that you marketing geniuses walk on water. So I'm really excited to have you on the show. So let's talk about, you know, spending 40 years building your agency, selling it for tens of millions, and now focusing on optimizing the humans.
So let me just build on that. My first job was selling jelly beans on a push cart in a shopping mall at 19. So I've been selling my whole life too. And, you know, a student of sales and a student of marketing. I've been really fortunate over those 40 years. I started just two guys in a little 600 square foot office. And we were very fortunate to start in the software business, and the agency grew. And we got clients out of Australia. And of course, I made numerous mistakes. My father was a physician. My family is physicians. I was the black sheep and said, I just don't want to be a physician. I don't want to stay in the hospital. And he passed away at 19. I go, oh my God, now what am I going to do? And I was on my own and I had to figure it out. And I had a love of direct mail and mail order marketing. I thought I could get rich in mail order marketing. And I fell into what we call at that time, it was the direct response mail order business. But through that growth, I grew the business. I made mistakes like, oh, I'm thinking if I had a fancy office, that will attract the clients because my ego was so small. No, that just caused me to go bankrupt. And because I realized, no, you know, I need to spend all my time and my people. And then I was fortunate to grow and we got to a certain level around $10, $12 million in sales and I couldn't get through it. I didn't understand why. And I know you're talking about your mentor. I was in a taxi cab getting ready to go to Chicago Airport from a trade show. And my competitor jumped in the same car. He said, can I ride with you? And that competitor during the ride said, you know, I sold my agency. I know you're trying to sell your agency. Would you let me be your mentor? It's going to be 5 years, but I'd like to see if I could change my magic. And the truth is he did transform me and taught me what it took to take an agency up to $100 million and to be able to sell it to a public company in the time being. So, I have made my fair share of mistakes and learned a lot. And I think the core that you and I learned is that while we are great at marketing and I understand persuasion and messaging and neuroscience and CRM and data analytics, I can, you know, those are all great outsides. But in the end, growing the agency from 2 to 50 to 100 to 200 to 400, the key of any success is its people. And the truth is, I wasn't really a good people leader until the last 5 years of my career. It took me a long time to become self-aware about the critical importance of connecting with those people, of spending time and realizing that the only competitive advantage the agency had was our people. And so my mission now is to help leaders from the Fortune 500 to large mid-sized organizations realize that your customer satisfaction, your revenue growth, your profit, your valuation happens in the point between the middle manager and the employee. And that 70% of that interaction between the middle manager and the employee affects the rest of that profit chain. And the good news is that you can teach managers how to become what I like to say is magnificent middle level leaders. I like the word magnificent because it lets them know that we're there to unleash the magnificence of every human being. We're there to honor their magnificence as a unique individual in the world. And it's our job as a leader at whatever role is to connect with them and reveal and find their best passion. Because we're at a stage where you have 75% disengagement, 50% quitting, everybody looking for a new job, low passion, which is costing companies fortunes. You know, I could rattle off tons of statistics in terms of the cost of disengagement from loss of market share, loss of revenue, loss of just turnover attrition, the cost to replace, intelligence. And so it's so easy to change that. Yet so many companies say, well, if I just invest in a new technology, I'm going to invest everything in AI, that's going to change it all. In the end, no business operates without great people, and great people don't happen without what I would call magnificent managers that are inspiring and passionate and leading.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking about that, I think about this idea of, you know, growing staff to 400 people, growing revenue over 100 million. And there can be such a temptation, depending on our backgrounds or where we grew up business-wise, to see people as maybe too interchangeable. You know, like, I think about myself. I am, you know, I was in private equity and in the energy space, and it's very asset-driven. You know, and it's like we were looking at doing, we had brought this small hydro renewable energy technology over from France, and you put it in all these weirs, and like 95% of the capital cost was the equipment, right? And this idea of like, and then we'll just have people run it. Like, in many ways, in that business, like, you had it. So guarantee is like a swear word in investing, unless it's the government guaranteeing you. Okay, so we had the opportunity for guaranteed for power purchase agreement guarantees from the government, right? So, like, the government was buying the power either way. Do you know what I mean? Like, the staff weren't making the difference on that kind of customer, right? And the ways that I think it did me a disservice is this idea of, like, as we've been in other industries, thinking that good enough people are good enough kind of thing, and that they're so interchangeable. And then I got to do this, you know, like, the people who had been our leadership training company, I'd got a CEO coach, and we had them do trainings for our staff. So I ended up going to work for them after, you know, I kind of got taken out by 2008. I was feeling sorry for myself, crying to my mail, because I'm thinking, like, should I go back and do an MBA? I was like, no, I think it'd be better to go work for those guys. And I got to train, you know, do leadership training for these Navy SEALs and Microsoft and Oracle and these, you know, all these different clients, and then ended up quitting, starting my own of that. And it's like, for special ops, for instance, like, you take big army, and it's like, if we had wanted you to have a brain, we'd issued you one at basic training. You know, like, it is very much like, some of the worst places in big army are like, the colonel thinks and we all just do, right?
Yeah.
But
yes.
In special operations, the triangle's upside down. It's almost more like the servant leadership approach. And it's like,
yes,
like, they're training those enlisted men so well, they could actually trust their judgment. And then when you get to the classified units of special ops, like the real, like, we get Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein guys, right? It's like very much like run by the senior enlisted guys. Like, it is like, they're doing the planning, and these leaders are like spending so much time making sure they have everything they need to do their job. And like, but those are the guys who are doing the thinking and the executing, and like, very much, it's almost like a pro athlete team. Where it's like, yes, there's a general manager. Yes, there's a coach. Yes, there's all these people. But like, we're making sure Michael Jordan has everything he needs to get that ball in the hoop.
Yeah. So let me just build upon that for a second. So in special ops, the interesting piece is that you could have two teams, I know reading the book, that are carrying boats out into the water, and one team is always in the lead and the other team's in fourth position. And all they do is change the leader of the boat. And the leader who was the leader of boat number one now takes the lowest position of boat number four. And lo and behold, that team now becomes second position. So, they were able to quantify that it is the leader of the team that inspires the team. And I do also think that we forget in business, we are running pro athletes. We want to win, right? We're playing for big money, $100 million, $1 billion. And I remember working for a very large Fortune 2. And the CEO thought, oh, my people are just cogs in the wheel. I could just change them out. There doesn't really matter. So that industrial era thinking is dead for sure now. It was probably dead back then, because when you think of someone as just replaceable, you're devaluing them. And when they're devalued and they know they're devalued, guess what? They're showing up half-hearted. And so, yeah, your equipment might be doing it, but they're not bringing you innovation. They're not bringing you creativity. They're not bringing that. And pro teams, that's the job of the leader. I resource my athletes who are top of the game, and I get out of the way because that's why I have them. And I think that's where I'm at here with pro businesses, which is your managers, your magnificent managers should be able to collaborate, create, innovate, and make change. And you leaders at the very top, just make sure they have the resource and get out of the way. The heartbeat of the business is in the middle, not at the top and not at the bottom. It's in the middle. It's the nucleus. And so that, I think, is the where we are. We can see how much it affects engagement, which is Gallup has proven and Harvard's proven and McKinsey's proven, dramatically transform it. So I do hear that. And I also felt the same way when I was running my business very young in my career. Oh, they're just people like, you know, you made a mistake, you're fired, I'll get somebody new. I had no idea of the demoralization, of the cost, of the turnover. So people are special. And I'll tell you a story. Just the other day, a guy calls me as, hey, I work for a printing facility. We spent $200 million to buy this really specialized, personalized material to print out direct mail. Okay, we're still in the marketing space. But you know what? We don't have any people who knows how to use the strategy to make this $200 million machine produce for the client. So they got a huge capital cost, but they don't have the brain power to capitalize on the cost. And what we don't remember is how many touch points happen in a day, in a week, when if someone was passionate, they might have one more idea. Hey, did we think about that? Did we worry about that? Did I discern that idea? So we're not, we are all replaceable, right? We know that we're all replaceable, but there is a cost of replacement, and it's so much more effective for new companies to develop the talent in the right way. Not everybody wants to be the leader. Not everybody is ineffective. The question is, I like to use what's called 9 box, where you can identify emerging stars, rapid leaders, strong contributors, those are not quite fitting, and then coach them, have an adaptable coaching style of, I'm empowering you, you're an emerging leader, you're a star, I'm empowering you, just like we talked about pro athletes. Hey, you know what, you're new to the team, you need probably a directive style. Hey, you're not a fit, well, let's talk about maybe you're not in the right role. Hey, you're a great contributor, but you're not a people leader, well, let's help you advance and be excited, but not put you in a role that's not your natural skill. And so it requires our magnificent middle managers to be aware of themselves and their people and not approach them as cogs, because we're not.
Well, this is exciting. I mean, one of the reasons I was excited to have you on the show is this concept that specifically for creatives, you know, I want to be right in the movie business eventually. Our commercial real estate fund, we're trying to build like one-of-a-kind artistic action sports resorts, like for action sports families, yeah, by national parks and snowboarding mountains and stuff, I guess. And we're not just looking for like somebody to follow an architect and like punch these out like we're in an elf village and all the houses look the same. Like, we're trying to win awards for architecture at these places, right? And I think about, like, you know, you grow an agency to 100 million revenue, you sell to, you know, such a big firm. I think they're like $17 billion market cap at Omnicom today. You worked for so many of, like, with the marketing teams, it's biggest, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world. I go down your website, I see the, you know, Paramount Pictures and HBO, and I mean, so many recognizable logos, right? And, you know, this idea that, like, the concept that our emotions wouldn't change our creative output has got to be just completely crazy. You know, that, like, how your creatives feel isn't going to change the kind of thoughts they have on how to grow this business, how to grow your clients. I mean, like, that's such a clear correlation, right? So I'm like really interested in your insights of like specifically applied to creatives.
No problem. So let's just talk about creative inspiration. So I led creative teams from 2 to 50 to 100. I'm a student of creative inspiration. I'm a student of creativity, and I'm a student from IDEO. IDEO is the great design studio. If your creatives are not inspired about the purpose or mission of the work, you're only going to get half work. Because the creative mind gets the reward from pushing and breaking through and finding the new combination. And that's hard work. And the first thing those creative minds need to do is throw out all the trash. So the first hour of the creative process is garbage, right? It's all the raw ideas. But the other aspect of the creativity is they feel safe speaking an idea and allowing it to get built and not be criticized. So many times in my early days, I was fast to bring a solution. I know the creative idea, this is the solution, done, and I didn't realize how demoralizing it was. In my older years, I recognized the most important thing I could do as the leader was make sure they had pizza, give them what was necessary, and give them the time and space to ideate, because you can't rush the intersections. You can start, but the mind needs to process. And so what we did learn for great creativity is to allow reflection, a day, a two, to walk away, to go around the block, and let the subconscious do its magic. I think the other thing is the environment of which those creatives work in needs to inspire them. We would take our creatives to the Museum of Modern Art. We would bring our clients to those museums to set the tone of that we're here for high creativity, because high creativity changes impact, engagement, result, value. Look, let's just talk, here's Disney, right? There's high creativity. So fostering a culture of innovation is crucial. Safety is crucial. The other thing with great creativity is a lot of ideas. If there's one thing I learned from IDEO, it's generate as many as possible, as fast as possible. And don't filter at the beginning. Let them come, let them rip, and then use these inspirational questions. Well, what if it was this? What if it was that? What is the inverse? And don't start editing until days later, because the best ideas come from quantity and collaborative building. So that's what to me is important in creativity. And also, what is the communication of creative? So as a student of neuromarketing and neuroscience, we are visual creatures. We survive because we see things at 14 milliseconds. But we also survive because we don't take in everything that we're exposed to, you know, the 3,000 or 10,000 messages. So as you're doing architecture, which I love, architecture speaks volumes without saying a word, right? The lines of an arc of a building, the design, the texture, the tone, the material used for your adventure park or whatever it might be, is speaking. And we as humans can hear with no words. 60% of our communication is nonverbal. And so I think it's wonderful in your that you're want to win an award, because an award is saying is we as others recognize you're communicating and telling a story through style, structure, tone, material, whatever it is from architecture. In marketing, I'm telling the story through people, delivery, the story of the individual, the idea and message. But so many forget what is the essence of how do you awaken the brain, because we're designed not to be awakened, and then how do I create persuasion within the brain? So that's a kind of my riff on creative. We can go from there.
Yeah. So I'm such an IDEO fan. I, you know, read the books. I've got the cards, you know. I got to go to one of their classes in New York, and then I got to take some classes at the D School and at Stanford. And I think about these things of like breaking up the groupthink, you know, and like, you know, if you go to the magazine rack at the store, like go look at a magazine you'd never normally look at to see if you can steal something from some arena that everybody who thinks like you wouldn't think of. So like for me, that's like, I think about, so I love Barnes & Noble so much. It's like
yes,
my happy place,
yes.
Right?
So you want, funny thing is that is my happy place, is the magazine rack. And when I was growing up as a young kid, my father always believed, even if you got one sentence from a magazine or a book, it was worth the investment. And so we would have hundreds of magazines on our table and all the rest of that. And of course, you're looking for the unique or the different combination or the inspiration. I'm a big fan of the serendipity of success. If your mind is open, you don't know where that inspiration will come from. But if you've already predetermined the idea, you're not allowing yourself to find the idea from, I don't know, Town and Country that could apply to your architecture.
Yeah.
It's not probably the best combination. So maybe it's knitting that would apply.
Yeah. So I want to talk about, you brought this word persuasion. Let's, you know, a lot of our listeners are like founders and CEOs and like investment fund managers. And I want to talk about both persuasion is applied. You know, you've got direct response, B2B. You know, that's something a lot of people don't have figured out. So I'd love to hear a lesson of persuasion for all of us trying to attract a new customer, and then a lesson of persuasion for all of us in trying to attract the best out of our own employees.
Okay. So persuasion, you start with, what am I trying to persuade? What is the influence I'm trying to make? In my line of work, it was, what was the behavior I was trying to do? And when you're trying to create persuasion, you, when you know how the mind works, which is our minds keeps us alive by only paying attention to what it needs to at that moment for survival. And if it grabs our attention and then gets processed in our logical mind and determines, is it right for me? And is it going to give me a strategic value, an economic value, or an emotional value? And should I take action or not? So persuasion is how you communicate that. And, you know, the best way is through picture and story. Comparison is one of the most important aspects of persuasion. Finding the emotive story within it, because storytelling is how we have carried on their messages from generation to generation. And so where is the story within the persuasion? Because I want to listen to a story, but it's not a story. It's a story of picture. Now, I'm not the greatest storyteller, but if we started to talk about, an anvil and a heavy iron and horseshoeing, which I work around, and as he's hitting the horseshoe and it's red and glowing, you can see that picture. And so persuasion is good with the storytelling of what can be and what will be from the aspects of emotionality, strategic, and financial value. Auditory is extremely important, you know, because our ear is not as fast as our eye, but it triggers a whole different nerve. And in the end, we're irrational decision makers. I'm sure you've had guests on that talked about, you know, irrational decision making. We go down the aisle and next thing we know I go to Costco, I'm a golfer, and I'm going down to go get a chicken, but two boxes of golf balls just jump into my cart. Now, I don't know how the heck that happened, but they just came running in and dropped in. You know, so we're irrational decision makers, and great persuaders understand the irrationality of the decision and use that to their advantage, not to manipulate, but to their advantage to have their message resonate, starting with, I got you to awaken to the message. I touched you emotionally that it's either a pain, a significant pain. You can be losing a lot of money. It could be greed. Hey, this investment is going to be 100x. It could be emotive or strategic. This is going to make you feel like you are unique among all your peers. But once that's done, now the rest of the argument then gets processed really quickly in the logic. So that's the aspect of persuasion. And in marketing, we used it because I would always try to lead with, what is the solution? What is the pain that this problem is solving? We sell more aspirin than we do vitamins. And I know it's not exciting and new and breakthrough and AI, but this brain is, you know, we're only 100,000 years old. We're 10,000 as a Homo sapien. We stuck our phones in front of our faces just 20 years ago, but we are really a very primitive being. And great persuaders know how to use primitive storytelling.
So I'm interested in your years. Have you always been in Los Angeles?
I've always lived in Los Angeles, yes.
So I'm interested, when you have clients like Paramount or HBO who are already visual storytellers, what is this conversation like when you're helping them with their persuasion?
So let's take to some, so we'll go from Paramount. Some of the clients will go up to other aspects. How about DirecTV or AT&T or, you know, insurance companies? The storytelling is, and it depends upon the job. So if I'm at the brand level, I'm trying to make you feel like I'm the right brand for you and we have a fit. So Paramount and HBO, their storytelling in a manner that is emotive, that engages you to say, is that would be of interest. You know, We seek out unique because we don't want, we know to separate the cheetah who's hiding in the grass from the elephant that's standing there, right? We know that cheetah might come attack us, right? We are incredibly attuned with our eyes. And so great storytelling and even trailers to movies are designed to bring us in, to grab our curiosity and suck us in. At some levels, when we're working with television products and delivery services, mobile and wireless, those conversations are, well, are you solving a price problem? Are you solving a speed problem? Or have you forgotten what problem you're solving? Now, many times, and I say it with the sweetest heart, is that the lawyers are the anti-sales department, right? And because, you know, they make you put a half page of legal disclaimer in 4-point type or 6-point type, and the consumer gets skeptical about it. Sometimes it's just of, what is the price offer? Because they've already made the decision, let's just get down to the deal. And so when it comes to communication, you have to decide where you are in a funnel. A lot of my work was at bottom funnel, convert and sell and drive action. At higher funnel and awareness, you're doing something different type of storytelling. The other aspect is, I don't remember once. You know, frequency matters in terms of the fact that because I'm so distracted, I have to have multiple exposure, or I better be so powerful. My greatest story I like is Hallmark, when it's Christmas time or Mother's Day or Father's Day. Those commercials make you cry, you know, and you don't forget them. So great movies make us cry. Great storytellers make us cry. Great writers make us cry. And now in advertising, you don't always, they talk a lot about the story brand. You might have Volvo as a story brand, right? We know safety and keeping your kids safe is a story brand. You might have BMW as a story brand of the best engineering and driving car. But many brands just really suffer at that. You have The shoe company.
Zappo,
right? So they're a story brand in that you buy and we donate, right? So now they have an emotional aspect. Not only do I make it easy for you, but I donate, and the sock company. So story matters. You don't always get to tell it depending where it is. And it's not about the story. It's about the emotion it brings out, because that's when the hormones get released in our mind that are uncontrollable. That's the aspect, the irrational decision. The release of dopamine and oxytocin and all those wonderful hormones that say, I have to put this in my cart. Yeah. I got to go to the website. I got to check out. I got to go to the movie.
So let's take this to the next level. For those of us who want to follow in your footstep and create the kind of emotion in staff to help us grow from a $12 million a year to over $100 million a year revenue, what does that equation look like?
Okay. I'm going to tell you what it looks like. The first thing it looks like is recognizing every conversation with your staff matters, and not just you, the CEO. The truth is, you're important to set the credibility to build trust, because there's very low trust in senior executive communication that has happened over the years. But if you're modeling good, authentic communication, I'll talk about that in a second, and you're teaching and investing your middle, the magnificent middle, those people who got promoted because they were great individual contributors and now they're a team manager, but they really didn't learn how to be a coach. You know, unless you work with great coaches, how do you know how to coach a team? Well, you were a good contributor. So the second piece is investing the time and energy to teach them coaching skills, authentic listening skills, to set the time aside, that though 15 minutes a week with each individual, to know them within the right levels of boundary. You know, there's a very careful boundary of their personal life and their work life, but to authentically care, to be present, is what's going to start to drive the engagement. And so that requires investing in, what are the five fundamentals of high performing teams? You know, what are the working geniuses that make a team work? Why is psychological safety the foundation of every high-performing team in any sport and any business? What are the aspects of great coaching? What questions should you be asking to create connection, and why managing is not the same as people leading? Checking off what you did today is status. That doesn't build connection. Caring that maybe you have a sick child and you need a little flexibility today. Caring that you really want to move and gain a new skill that is complementary to you and the business and helping you get that happen. That's what matters. And so it's a type of conversation, but it's a story exchange between you and them, and listening, because we're always in such a rush. I got to get this done. But that rushing doesn't make the connection. But the one connection is worth millions. Keeping one high-valued employee is worth $1 million. They're not, as you and I started, they're not a cog. They're priceless. Keeping a young talent who just needs some guidance that could be your future leader and investing them is worth millions. So I think, and that also, I know for me, just like in yourself, is my transition to leadership happened when I invested in my own senior leadership team, and we took Clifton Strength Finder, which we now bring, and we revealed our strengths on a map, and we're vulnerable to what our strengths and weaknesses were.
By the way, do you know your top five offhand?
Do you know your top five? I don't know if I remember. I'm an inventor.
Okay.
I'm a strategist. I'm a enabler. I'm a galvanizer. I don't know if those are right, the words. My lowest, what I never forgot, was empathy. My wife says, oh, you have no empathy. Well, that's because she was right. I didn't take the time to know that it really mattered to care. But my top working geniuses are inventor and galvanizer. So I like to bring people together. How about your top five?
I don't know if this is the exact right order, but I think it's like,
okay,
maximizer, achiever, activator, learner, futurist.
Good memory. I'm a learner too. I love learning. We have 12 people on our management team when I was there, and you can see my president, she was an incredible relator with high empathy. And I just paired up with her. I said, Camilla, you're the gal. I will devise the strategy. I will go do the sales. I'll drive the business. But you take care of this good team. I don't know whether I could get to the level that you are. And so being vulnerable of your weakness and being able to call it, being able to then determine the pairing and work within the pairing, which we brought all the way through the company, that enabled us to go from 200 to 400 for Fortune 50 companies, because we were able to do things others weren't. Everybody was complimentary in how we worked. And so that was the competitive advantage in the people. Anybody can do advertising communication, but it's how you do it and how fast you do it and the quality. So that's how I think about people and what to grow your business. I hope I answered that question.
Yeah. When you think about this process of changing your mind and essentially reprogramming yourself.
Yes.
What were some of the tough parts? What were some of the wins?
The tough parts were realizing my weaknesses and owning them. The toughest parts were being vulnerable to say, as you know what, I didn't have a good role model when I was growing up. My dad ran a solo practitioner, and he came in and I just watched him run around his office, and that's how I thought you ran an office, and I knew nothing. And I think the other thing is I had that anger of, oh, you just, people are dispensable. You just turn them out. So I think the hardest part was to realize how little I knew. The most exciting part, and the transition happened when we was working one with my mentor, who helped me understand to grow a business for your people requires process and practice. Great sports team, practice. And so he taught me, Russell, you need to practice your processes with your people so they can run it with their eyes closed. That was transformative to what we did. And that allowed me to grow the business to sell. And then once we sold, being part of a large public company, I got to go to a thing called Omnicom University, which was taught by the greatest Harvard professors. And when you're at Harvard and you understand the level of sophistication and leadership and people skill and learning about what we call the service profit chain, which is really the underdriver of all of that I'm talking about, transformed. You know, I walked away with notebooks 8-10 inches thick of knowledge. And so the hardest part was practicing and using. And remember, you have a weakness. And when under stress, I would fall back to my directive style versus no. Your job now is to coach. Your job is to mentor. That time has come and directive does not help. So the self-awareness part was the hardest part, and owning it and putting it out there. Hey, you know what? And being willing to say, I'm sorry. I know how many people I would say is, if I've hurt your feelings because I talked quickly or I said something or I was, please come tell me. I promise you, I will apologize because you matter and I make mistakes. I'm only human and I'm glad to say I'm sorry. I don't sit on high. I'm just part of you.
That's great.
So those were important.
Yeah. What's another $100 million team success secret?
$100 million success secret.
Yeah, for the team specifically, like these high performing teams.
For a high performing team,
$100 million team success secret.
I got it. You got $100 million team. I think I'm going to give you the success secret that I witnessed. So, from IDEO, I also went to Case Western University and studied under two gentlemen, Ron Fry and David Cooper Ryder, on a tap process called appreciative inquiry.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was the weirdest set of words, appreciative inquiry. Okay, they developed it. Well, what is appreciative inquiry? Appreciative, the word appreciate has multiple meanings, means you value, it grows in value. It has a certain value to it. And inquiry is the investigation. And so when you have if you want to get to $100 million, the opportunity to get there is to conduct, I'll use the words, an appreciative inquiry, which really is, when is the company at its best? The research shows if you do root cause analysis all the time and focus on what's broken, you get more brokenness. There is case after case. Find out why our customer service levels fell 10 points, and what you get is another 10 points of failure. Find out why our customer service is at 90%, you get the last 10%. And the great story is BP ProCare found the number one impact on customer satisfaction was how fast the phone rang. If you answered the phone on the first ring, customer sat went through the roof, and so they competed for answering the phone. So now let's come back to the inquiry. If you bring 100 people within your organization together, focus them on a mission for 2 days of an important mission, allow them to use this process of getting to know each other in a different way when they were at their best, allowing them to then brainstorm against the mission to find ideas and problems, and then bringing them back so they could co-create together and generate dozens of ideas like we did with IDEO, you're going to get breakthrough solutions you never thought as possible, because the 100 million idea is not from 10 people, it's from 100 people. And so to be like IDEO, where you want hundreds of ideas, get 100 people together. And there is a formal process I'm not describing in all detail. It's called the 4D process of how you do it. But the magic is getting the heartbeat of the company together to co-create and build upon each other. And the little problems they see in the corner come to the center. And lo and behold, you've saved money. You've found a new marketplace. You've changed a process. You've created a new product. You found a new way to go to market. You've changed your strategies. You've improved your processes. You've improved your bottom line and grown your revenue. And most importantly, everybody was excited to be part of that because they got to control somewhat of their destiny and their future. They felt heard and valued and appreciated. And with that comes passion, and with that comes satisfaction of customers and revenue and profit.
Yeah. Well, I know we got to wind down here. Maybe my final question there is this idea of 100 million revenue, 400 employees. There can be such a struggle, even if the senior leadership are embracing this, to get that down to the front level employees who are actually interacting with our customers. And that, like you said, that frontline employee to their first manager level, like getting the water to the end of the row there. You know, for so many folks, it's like the CEO thinks they're doing a great job and they got the posters on the walls, but to other people, there's just posters on the wall, right?
That's so correct. That's
any thoughts you have of like getting it all the way out into the whole organization,
yes,
so that they're actually living it at the other end of the, at the other end of the organization?
Yes. Two pieces of it. Assume it's not getting out from the very beginning. That the senior team has to start with, I know I'm not doing a good job of coaching my seconds, and they're not doing a good job of coaching their thirds, and I need a consistent coaching, and I use coaching in the broadest term. I need to teach them how to be a good talent developer, a good inspirer, a good collaborator, a good hurdle overcomer. I need all that, and I have to do it consistently. And if I'm not doing consistently, then I can guarantee it's not going down.
And what about when they say, boss, did you want me to do this or get real work done?
And you say, you know what? You're going to get the real work done. And what we do know is to get the real work done, the real work of a leader is in their people. Now, we do have middle level front lines that's due 2 days of contribution, a day of 2 days of people they should be spending on, and a day of administration. But it's important for the top to recognize, hey, if you keep asking them to do both, you're going to burn them and lose them. And so it's this give and take. It's a more empathetic leadership style required now that they're already fried. So you do want them to be both an independent contributor. You do want them to be a leader. But if you teach them more skills, they'll be more joyful and they're going to get their people to do more work and the business will succeed. And so you think you can't afford it, but the truth is you can't afford not to do it. And you have to do it consistently. And the last beauty, which I'm just about, is that it's easy to give them a 1 to 2 minute video of a reminder. They don't need an hour class. Just give them little and tell them fun stories, make it enjoyable. Use coaching stories, use this story, use your own story. You know, but it's so easy to tell story at scale with AI-based generation, and they don't need a lot. They just need a little reminder that it matters. And if it's consistent, then they'll believe that you believe it. It's the inconsistency of leadership that creates you're a bunch of BS leader. You put a poster on the wall, baloney.
I love it. I love consistency. Well, listen, tell people the websites and the best place to find out more.
Okay. No problem. I really appreciate that. So the best place to find out about what we do in terms of unlocking the magnificent middle and transforming engagement is at kernandpartners.com. Very simple. KERNANDPARTS.com, kernandpartners.com. Go there. Our contact is there. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there. That's the two places that I spend my time. And I'm passionate about helping no matter what. It's my time to give back. I'd love to, of course, as an entrepreneur, make money while we're doing it, but I just want to help because as you and I started this conversation, to help one person is like helping the world. And so whether you have money or not, budget or not, doesn't matter. Come visit me. Come call me from Kernan Partners. Let's just talk about helping people become great, magnificent. Let's uncover their magnificence.
That's so great. Well, what do you want to leave people with today?
I want to leave them with, if you're a leader of any size company, you have a responsibility to nurture, care, develop, guide, support those individuals and the growth of their family and their careers. And it only happens when you are compassionate, you take the time to demonstrate care, and you honor the uniqueness of everybody that works for you. We're all made special. Everybody has special gifts. And for your company to be special, I want to leave you with the fact that it's your job to find how magnificent, and that is really my strap word, you know, I keep magnificent each person is, and to let that magnificence of what their strength and skills are be revealed to help you, their peers, their team, your customers, their family, their community.
Great. That's a mic drop.
All righty.
Okay. Bye, everyone.